What do I do now? Returning to bed after a short trip to the bathroom with her brown eyes sparkling in curiosity, my grandmother asks, "What do I do now?" My mother or my uncle, my aunt or my cousin or her paid caregivers, whoever is on shift that day, they help her lean back into her pillows and remind her, "Sleep, Mama. Now you sleep." "Oh," she says, and she sleeps. Until she wakes and then asks again, "What do I do now?" "Would you like to go to your chair?" they ask. "Okay." It's a journey of 20 feet and can take an hour, or at least feel like an hour. My grandmother, Elizabeth Betty Johnson Sutherland, is 94. She lives in Forks, Washington, which is a very small town in the rainforest in the northwest corner of the state. If you've heard of it, it's probably because you were an environmental activist in the 1990s following the spotted owl debate. Or you or someone you love has read the vampire novel series Twilight, which is set in Forks. My memories of Forks growing up in nearby Port Angeles in the 1980s are of a declining logging town. Sad, but distinct. Returning there now, you discover more activity. In fact, Main Street is filled with Twilight-related shops, staffed now by the adult children of out-of-work loggers. And there are lots of shoppers who have come from all over the place to catch a glimpse of Twilight mania, which makes the town feel even more sad. If you travel across Forks, a journey that takes all of 5 minutes, back to the Marietta Mobile Home Park, you'll discover my mother's childhood home, where my grandmother lives still. She can't move much, though on some days she has bursts of energy. My uncle calls her Lazarus. And they get her to church or a local pizza place. Mostly, though, she sits on her chair or her bed. Because she can't hear, conversation is minimal, which tortures her. She loves a good chat and loves to know what's going on. Before she lost all her hearing, she'd make a habit of looking for wherever was the loudest and liveliest conversation going on in a room and go sit herself right in the middle of it. She asks her question, "What do I do now?" repeatedly, like she can't believe the answer isn't something more momentous than sit, sleep, eat, bathe, dress. Like there's something else she should be doing, and she just forgot, needs a reminder. What do I do now? It makes perfect sense, given the relentless activity of her life. She gave birth to her first set of twins, my mother, Mary, and her twin brother, David, when she was 32. 9.5 years later, she had 7 children, all under the age of 10, which means 3 more singles and another set of twins. Can you imagine? What do I do now? We all ask this question, right? It actually is one that, in one way or another, we ask across our lives again and again as one stage of life ends and another begins. It's a question that seems to be about the future, but is actually rooted in the dreams of the past. We had a plan, a sense of who we wanted to be, a thought of what we thought we should do. Have children. Go to school. Get a new job or career. Retire. Marry. Divorce. So we go about planting seeds, doing the work, creating a new life. And then, though it may not have turned out exactly like we thought originally, and in fact it probably didn't, but in one way or another you did it. It's done. Your children arrive, you hold them in your arms, tiny and so utterly dependent upon you, and you are a parent. What do I do now? Or you say, I do, for better or worse, and you are married. What do I do now? Or you find that job you've been dreaming of, and lo and behold, you are the called and installed associate minister at a church in Fort Collins. Or rather, not you, me. What do I do now? As he made his way along the cloaks and palm leaves the crowd had set along his path toward Jerusalem, perhaps Jesus too asked himself this question. What do I do now? It's a common motif in world religions, the Holy One arriving in the city. As place transforms, so does the traveler. It marks a story of becoming. The young Siddhartha set on a path to become the Buddha after he first went into the city and saw its suffering. After a long journey, Mohammed, too, entered the city where he was greeted with shouts of joy and proclamations of God's goodness. Historically speaking, right as Jesus is said to have arrived, the Roman troops and cavalry also entered Jerusalem, headed by Pontius Pilate. They set it up as a contrast. On the one side, Jesus entering, and the other, the Roman cavalry and troops. These imperial powers came to enforce the rule of law during the season of Passover, when many thousands of Jewish pilgrims filled the city. The story of Jesus' arrival does indeed offer an obvious alternative to that Roman entrance. This is actually pretty common for Jewish and Christian stories. It may be hard for us to imagine it today, but in those first few centuries, Christianity was fringe of the fringe, hugely countercultural, actually a funny little cult thing that people weren't sure about. And so their authors were always looking for ways to proclaim a different story than that dominant mainstream narrative. This story said, our king is a humble carpenter's son who arrives on a donkey with no more adornment than tree branches and cloaks thrown upon a dusty path. Our king comes to enforce not the rule of law, but a rule of love. For the Christian community, this story asserted not just who Jesus was, but who they were and who they were to become. This story also positions Jesus as the fulfillment of the Jewish story that began in Hebrew Scripture. The author tells us he asked for the donkey because it fulfilled the prophecy that his life came to fulfill. He went into Jerusalem because it was somehow his destiny. The text is less clear, however, if Jesus himself understood it as his destiny. When he asked for those animals, did he realize what his entrance into Jerusalem would ultimately mean? Did he have any idea that in place of cheers of praise, a few days later he would experience a violent mob calling for his execution? Theologians have repeatedly debated variations on this question. Did he know? And if you are a theologian inclined to assert that Jesus is also God, then this question means you're actually asking, did God know what was going to happen? Did God send Jesus, God's own son, to earth knowing what would happen? And if so, does this mean that God is the ultimate child abuser? Now, when these questions came up in seminary amongst my Christian friends, I confessed, I breathed a sigh of relief. After all, for most Unitarians, Jesus isn't God. Jesus is human, like us. So the question of whether he knew about his destiny becomes simply a human question, which of course means there's still plenty of difficult sorting out to do. For do we know how things will all turn out when we begin? When does a person come to know who they are, what they are meant for, who they are meant to become? And how do we figure all that out? And once we think we have it, how do we go about actually becoming that, even while it often feels like a moving target? Some people spend their whole lives searching for their precise place, and some seem to know right from the beginning and never waver. My dad announced that he was going to be an architect when he was in first grade. He'll be 64 next week, and he's never done anything else. Most of us feel some combination of these two extremes. We are clear about some things, clueless about others, trying to live into others. Some parts of ourselves develop as a great and pleasant surprise, and we welcome them as true. Other things we declare as truth early on in life, but never quite achieve them in reality. We're just sure we'll be partnered with children, only to discover that life as a single person without kids is our so-called destiny. Was that Jesus? Did he think his life would go one way and then it went another? Maybe growing up in that carpenter's home, he thought he too would smell of sawdust. His hands too would be rough and yet somehow tender. Perhaps he too imagined that he would bring his own son, passing down those skills from generation to generation. But then something in him offered a different path, set him to teaching and leading, liberating and healing. A seed was planted and he nurtured it and it him until one day he found himself calling for a donkey so he could enter the city where he would meet his death. Did he know? Do any of us know how things will turn out? Today, we do know the end of Jesus' story, but it doesn't mean he did then. Right then, at that moment, in fact, I actually think he felt triumphant. A rush of power and possibility. As the crowds laid their cloaks and the palm leaves down before him, it was like a gigantic yes to him, to his message, and to their experience of his ministry. Yes, your dreams were valid. On target, we see in you what you feel in yourself. In Unitarian Universalism, we speak about true vocation requiring both an internal and external calling. You might have a sense of who you are, but if no one else seems to agree, you might be a little off, and vice versa. From this understanding, becoming your truest self is not a matter of discovering and seizing upon some ontological reality, but rather it is a deeply relational and evolutionary process that can only fully occur in loving, trusting, and differentiated community. It requires both an ongoing awareness of self and your particular skills, gifts, passions, as well as an awareness of others and their particular yearnings and needs. As Frederick Buchner puts it, to discover the place where you are called, you must uncover where your own deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Traveling along those palms into Jerusalem, Jesus found that meeting place and fulfilled his calling. It was precisely his path to take. And yet, even if he did not know how the story would end, I have to imagine that in addition to triumph, there was also a tinge of grief. After all, any such transformation holds not just the promise of the new, but the loss of the past. We look back on the dream that brought us here and consider what it means to be here rather than there. Feelings of sadness in such moments are inevitable. You think you want to retire after 40 years in the ministry, but then you do, and it's good, but also it's sad. Becoming requires loss, and grief is inevitable. Of course, to be at this place of asking, what do I do now, means the change is done. There's no going back. You're already someplace new, already someone new. You can go down that rabbit hole of regret, but sooner or later, life is going to require making that turn towards acceptance. You might remember that a while back, and it's totally escaping me how long ago this was, but Mark had a sermon on hindsight. He talked about Captain Hindsight from South Park. Do you remember? Basically, he said, now let's see if I remember it accurately. He said, hindsight's a lie because you only know what you know now because it's now. You couldn't have known it then because it was then. So we all make the best choices in the moment with the information we have now. That's all we can do. And like Jesus, fully human that we are, we can't know how all will turn out on this threshold or the next. And so you should cut yourself, your former self, some slack. This was more or less the message, I think. That's what I remember of it. So be nice to your former self and offer yourself not judgment, but perhaps curiosity. Fascinating. Who was I then? What was I thinking? What was I longing for when I started down this path? And what have I learned since? And what does all this tell me about my values that could be helpful as I discern what it is I'm becoming next? Which brings me back to my grandmother. When my mom first started telling me about this question she asks and how puzzled she can get, I wanted to say, good God, doesn't she just get to do nothing now? I mean, I didn't tell you earlier, but before she had those 7 children, she was a registered nurse for 10 years. And before that, she worked hard in her growing up years on a farm in Fargo, North Dakota. After her children were raised, she was very active in her community, especially helping the Vietnamese immigrants and others that were overwhelmed by poverty. She was a passionate advocate of education and literacy, and in the 1970s, she helped to found Fork's first food bank. And she was very active in her Catholic church. We actually used to joke that she was the bishop of Forks. On top of all of this, she cared for her own mother into her late 90s in that same home where she now lives. What do you do now, Grandma? Nothing. You did it. You get to rest now. But like so many of us, this answer seems unacceptable. Who am I if I'm not doing? Who am I if I'm not figuring out what's next? What's the plan? How can I move forward? We may affirm our worth as inherent, but the way we live our lives, it's more like we affirm our worth by way of our productivity. What do I do now? Take a breath. Let others do the lifting for a while. The world will indeed keep on going while you rest. Trust you are worthy of love even when you are doing nothing. Trust that you don't have to be 94 to have this be true. Our partners are everywhere. The gifts of grace are everywhere. Carrying forward the ways of love, even in your stillness. It's hard to do nothing, believe me, I know. But only in these breaks can we really see and receive all of life's abundant gifts. We are always on our way from one place to another, beginning anew. We imagine these between places as the exception, but they are, in fact, our everyday. They are life. Our lives are a series of what do I do nows. Our lives are that mix of triumph and grief, eager anticipation and fretful anxiety, memory and hope. Let us honor it all. Take it all in. And together, keep on moving forward. Amen. Blessed be.